So we had dinner together, but I am really looking forward to getting to know her. For some reason, we seem to just hit it off within the past hour that we have met. And I was told that she has a story that is one of the best stories that people have heard. And I can't wait to just hear her experience, strength, and hope to be shared with us. So enjoy, everybody. Here's Tammy.
Where are you going? My name's Tammy, and I'm an alcoholic. Nervous alcoholic right now. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. It's always a privilege and an honor to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. Jerry, I don't know where Jerry is, but he's been so funny calling me talking about Debbie. Because I didn't call Debbie right back, so Jerry calls. He's like the head honcho here. He says, you really need to call Debbie back. She's a little worried. She's kind of new in the program, and she's from New Jersey. Then he'd talk a few minutes. He'd say, but she's from New Jersey. So I don't know. I guess we feel for you here in the South coming here. And she talks too fast. I was like, usually somebody from here, they get up and read, and you have quite a while to relax, you know. Anyway, very glad to be here. I love your theme, See and Share Love. And I'm going to tell you, I felt it here. It's always good to come to AA where you really, you feel that love and warmth, and you guys really, you have it here, and thank you for making me feel welcome. Even though I don't want to speak, I feel welcome here at your AA event. A few things that are pretty important. First, my sobriety date is July the 16th, 1991. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. I have a home group. It's the Prattville Downtown Group. We meet every night of the week. If you're ever in Prattville, which I don't know why you would be, Prattville, Alabama, unless you're a golfer, you might be there. Please come by and see us. I truly think it's the best home group in the world, and I've heard if you don't think that about your home group, you need to get another one, and I believe that. I have a sponsor, and I think all those things are very, very important. I will tell you this, speaking is my least favorite thing to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd rather do anything else, put up tables, chairs, coffee, anything but speak. I used to say when I was first in AA, I wouldn't even share in meetings. And when I was over a year sober, an old timer said, Tammy, you need to share some in meetings. Share your experience, strength, and hope. And I said, well, I'm shy. And now he knew me when I was drinking. He said, girl, there ain't a shy bone in you. He said, there's nothing wrong with you, but you're full of self-centered fear. And why don't you try working the steps, and maybe God will remove enough of that self-centered fear so you can share your experience, strength, and hope. And he was right. I still don't like doing it, but God removes enough that I'm able to get up here and do it. I've had some experiences with speaking. The first time I ever spoke at an AA meeting, they took four of us out from an institution. Now, I would have done anything to get out of that institution. I think I would have tried to sing a song if you wanted me to. And we were all supposed to speak 15 minutes at this AA meeting. And so I got up behind that podium, and I was a nervous wreck, and I started fidgeting. I put my foot up on a shelf, and the whole thing went rolling out on the floor. It had wheels on it, and this was a group in Wetumpka, Alabama, and there was a lot of old-timers, and they were all just looking at me like, what in the hell is she doing to our podium, And the next time I spoke, I'd been sober over a year, and I spoke at a group in Selma, Alabama, and it was in this old building about to fall in, and I went in the bathroom to pray, and I put my purse on the sink, and the whole sink came off the wall. So I just pushed the sink back up and went and sat down, and a few seconds later, the door banged open, and water was just spraying because it busted a pipe. And I was like, Lord, what happened? And And so I'm always really nervous when I get up here to speak. So hopefully, since I'm the Lone Ranger up here, Debbie, I'll be okay. I mean, they read and got off the stage, didn't they, quick? I've always wished I was a funny speaker. I love funny speakers. I love to listen to them and just laugh and laugh. And I told my sponsor one time, I just want to be a funny speaker. And she said, well, Tammy, your story's pretty sad. So I really, you know, I'm going to tell you what it was like for me and what happened and what it's like for me today. It is good to be amongst my own people in the South. I know that, you know, you guys can understand me. If I speak in the North, and I've spoken Canada several times, I can see them out in the audience going, what'd she just say? You know, they don't understand my language. And I was telling Debbie at dinner, I was at a conference and I was speaking, and there was one of the California speakers was before me, and there was an interpreter there signing. And I watched that poor lady when that California speaker was up there, and she was just like this. I mean, just trying to keep up, you know how fast they talk. And then later that day I spoke, and I looked over at the signer when I was speaking, and she was like this, like she was doing a hula dance. I guess she was trying to get that draw, that southern draw. It was so funny, so funny. So anyway, you guys understand my language, right? So I can, you know, language of the heart, southern style. But anyway, my story is, you know, I was born in Montgomery. My mother got pregnant when I was really young. I was really, really young. Boy, was I ever young. Hold on, I'll get some more water on that one. My mom got pregnant when she was really young. And back in the 60s, that wasn't so cool to do. And so my dad, he rode a motorcycle, had long hair. Shot pool for a living, sold a little dope on the side. And that's the way it all started for me. And I guess you could say right away I went from the Leave It to Beaver family, you know. That's the way it started. I have one brother. My dad left when I was 3. I always had a lot of resentment about him leaving. And today I know he did the best he could, you know, and it probably was the best thing that could have ever happened. So anyway, that's the way it all started out. I grew up in Montgomery. My mom, you know, she was a single mom. She did the best she could for me and my brother. I can tell you this, growing up, I always felt different. I always felt different. I never quite fit in. I didn't fit in with the cool kids. I didn't fit in with the jocks. I didn't fit in with the smart kids. I just never fit. I didn't fit in at church. I was raised a Catholic. Any Catholics in here? You know, it's busy in the Catholic church. And I, Neil sit stand. You know, and I just never could keep up. I have one grandmother that's Catholic, and I have one grandmother that was Southern Baptist. So I was always really confused with religion, and so it just never did anything for me, you know? I didn't fit. It didn't work for me. And it was like that for me growing up until I was 12 years old, and I took my first drink of alcohol. Now, I don't remember a lot about my childhood, but I remember my first drink. Me and my best friend went and got drunk. We lived in the projects. I lived upstairs. She lived downstairs. She was 11 years old, and I was 12. And we went out, and we got drunk on red malt duck. And I can remember that night. I can remember drinking those wine coolers. And as it went down and that effect hit me, it was like magic. It was like I had found a magical potion, honestly. For the first time in my life, I fit in. I felt as good as pretty as funny as. I mean, I'd do whatever you wanted, dance on the car, whatever. Life meant something at last, you know, and I had found an answer. Now, I got in trouble the first time I drank, and I got in a lot more trouble from that point on. You know, they talk a lot about that line we cross over into alcoholism. I don't know much about that line, but I'll tell you this. From that night on, I believe I crossed it that night. Because if I wasn't drinking, I was 12 years old. So, of course, I couldn't drink every night. But if I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about it. I was planning it. I couldn't wait till the next time that I could get it. So I truly believe I crossed that line into alcoholism. I got in trouble that first night. We made it home, and I made it into my room, and I didn't get caught. But my best friend, now she's 11 years old, she goes home, and she starts throwing up. So she's in there throwing up, and her mother comes in there, and she says, "Well, honey, have you been drinking Kool-Aid?" "No." "Eating red candy?" "No." So her mother rushed her to the emergency room, thought she was hemorrhaging because she was throwing up that red wine. So they got to the emergency room. The doctor came out laughing and said, "There's nothing wrong with this kid, but she's drunk on red wine." So she was busted. So then, of course, her mom called my mom, and I was busted. And I can remember my mom coming in there and waking me up, and she beat my, you know what, and put me on restriction for 10 years or whatever it was. I don't even remember. But, you know, it really didn't matter what the consequences were because I had found an answer. I had found magic, you know, and I had crossed that line. So from that point on, it just started spiraling downhill. You know, I started doing other things. I started smoking other things. I started skipping school. Drugs are part of my story. I don't go into a long drug story, but, you know, I'll kind of sum it up like my Uncle Clarence summed it up. Now, my Uncle Clarence was a wino like we view winos. You know, the trench coat, he had on the trench coat, had the wine in the paper bag. He stayed under the bridge. He'd come home the first of the month. He got a check. We'd rob him. He'd go back under the bridge. You know, just the typical old wino life. And one night I'd been out all night. I woke up. I was sick, hungover. And I said, "Clarence, give me a drink of that wine." And I took a big old drink of Clarence's wine, and it was hot, wild Irish rose. Some of y'all drank that. It's tough, too. And I took a big old drink of it, and I spit it out, and I looked at Clarence with all the disgust you can imagine. I said, "Clarence, you ain't nothing but a wino." And that man looked back at me with all the disgust you can imagine, and he said, "Well, at least I'm not a any-o. You'll do any damn thing." Now, Clarence summed me up that night. That's my drug story. I was an Ennio. I would drink Crown Royal or Mad Dog 2020. You know, if I was in a bar, you could just give me a handful of pills. I just took them. It could be X-Lax or anything, you know. I'd drink it, smoke it, snort it, and it didn't matter. So Clarence just summed my whole drug story up. I was an Ennio, and that's what I was. So it started just going downhill. In the eighth grade, I quit school. And about the time I was about 15, 16 years old, and my knight in shining armor came in, and he robbed drug stores for a living. Wow. Yeah. Man, life really meant something then, you know. And we just gallivanted around the Southeast, just, you know, burgerizing drugstores. And it was just wonderful. What a life. It was great. And the chances are when you live like that, you're going to get caught. And we did. And we got caught in Mississippi. And he went to jail. They called my mom to come get me because I was a juvenile. And he got sentenced to 40 years at Parchman there in Mississippi. And there I was on the streets, you know, 17 years old. I was a daily drinker and user. You know, I'd started going in and out of juvenile detention. And I had to do the things you have to do to get that next drink on the streets. And a lot of them things I'm not proud of. But every day when these baby blues opened, it was, who am I going to rob, con, cheat, manipulate to get that next drink? I heard a speaker, I think it was Wino Joe, said, and it was just my life to a T, he said every morning when he woke up and he threw his arm off the bed, if it was carpet, it was going to be a good day. And if it was concrete, it was going to be a bad day, you know? And that's kind of the way my life was already at that time. Let's see, when I was 17 years old, I think I may have been trying to make geographical cures. You know, that's what we call it in AA. Like, we know what those big words mean. But anyway, I came to Georgia. I guess I was going to start over. And at 17, I remember I got locked up in Troup County, Georgia, LaGrange. That's a rough jail. I heard they closed it down. This was in the late 70s. It was really a rough jail. 17 years old, I went to jail there. And I stayed in that jail for about 9 months because my bond was like $500,000. I mean, all I did was, you know, write some bad scripts and use credit cards. But, hey, they don't play in Georgia. And so I can remember in there they gave us 2 meals a day, and they came from the big men's prison here. I forgot the name of it. Reedsville, I think it's the name of it. And by the time the food would get there, it would be cold. And, like, I remember, like, the meat in the mornings, like, if it was bacon, it would still have the hairs all in the meat from the – I guess they killed the hogs right there, and they cleaned them sometimes, and they didn't sometimes. The grits were weapons. You honestly could hurt somebody with the grits. They were so hard. We got 1 bath a week. That's how many times they let us out of our cell. There was 5 of us in a 4-bed cell. And I can remember my mom coming up there. You know, she'd come every week. She'd drive up here to Georgia. And she would just cry the whole time visiting me through that little window. My brother, I have one brother, and he's just my heart. And he's always just loved me to death. He came there one time. This was the only time my brother ever visited me in jail. And, you know, I think he was about 15 or 16 then. You know, that's that cool age where you're tough and, you know. And he walked up there and saw me in that jail. And he just busted out crying. And he ran out to the car. And he never visited me again in a jail. Ever. But, you know, you would think that would wake you up. Because that was the roughest stay in any jail I'd ever been. But, you know, they let me out of there. I went into this kangaroo court, and they sentenced me to 30 years on probation. 30 years! And so, anyway, they let me go. 30 years probation, Troup County, Georgia. And I was glad to get out of Georgia, let me tell you what. And, you know, I needed a drink after all that. I needed a drink. And I took that drink, and I was just like a Tasmanian devil. You know, the funny thing about when they locked me up here, I was 17. The first thing I said was, call my mom. I'm a juvenile. They said, not in Georgia. And they put me in that big people jail. And so I went back to Alabama and, you know, took a drink. It was just the same old thing until they locked me up in Alabama. And when I was 18, I had my first case in the real court. I went in front of the judge there, and I had this 30 years probation in Georgia. And I had a, you know, I'm standing in front of this judge, and so Georgia didn't want to extradite me. And this judge, I can remember, he sentenced me to 10 years in the penitentiary, and he suspended it. And he gave me 5 years probation. And all my Georgia time was gone then because, you know, Georgia didn't want me back. And I can remember standing in front of that judge and him saying some things that were just like beyond my comprehension. He said, and I want you to get a job. I was like, a job? What's that got to do with anything? I want you to go to school, get a job, do something. You know, and I can remember leaving that courtroom that day, and like any good alcoholic, I needed a drink after all that. And I don't know about you, but I didn't do probation well drinking and drugging. This lady over here is identifying too much. I didn't do probation well drinking and drugging, and I never reported. But, you know, during that time, this keen alcoholic mind started trying to figure out what the problem was. What is the problem? And I did. Montgomery was my problem. Montgomery, Alabama. And there is more police there than there are people. You know, and they're always picking on me, you know. So this keen alcoholic mind, I came up with a plan. I'm going to go to Texas. And I'm going to start over, and it's going to be beautiful. And I could see it in my mind, me in Texas with a good-looking cowboy, a ranch, you know, drinking good bourbon, horses, cow. It was beautiful. So I hitchhiked to Dallas, which would be your first clue that it wasn't going to be that great. And I got to Dallas and I took a drink and, you know, there I was. You know, when I came to AA, you guys, you say, everywhere you go, there you are. I say, what in the hell do they mean by that, you know? And today I know what you guys meant, because there I was in Dallas, right on Harry Hines Boulevard, if anybody's ever been to Dallas. And I was right there in the middle of it all, and, you know, it was just like a Tasmanian devil. And I, you know, I stayed on the run for a couple of years, and I don't know if any of you have ever lived on the run, but you get really tired. And after a couple of years, I did what a lot of good alcoholics do. I called Mom and wanted to come back and face the music. And so I came back to Alabama. I was 21 years old, and I came back to face that judge. And I went in front of him, and he sentenced me to that 10 years that he suspended. And I can remember being really scared, you know. And I remember laying in that county jail, and, you know, all I knew about prison is what I'd seen on TV. And I said, you know, I'm going to get up there, and they're going to slap me down and take all my stuff. I mean, all my stuff. Y'all know the movies we see on TV, you know. And I was scared to death, and I said that old jailhouse prayer that probably a lot of you have said, God, if you'll just get me out of this one, and we all know the rest, don't we? I swear I'll never drink again. And you know what? The doors didn't boom open. And I said, see, there's no God. And if there is a God, I've been dealt a pretty bad hand. And that was my whole view of it. You know, I was just, I've been dealt a pretty bad hand. And so, you know, that was my first trip. I took to Julia Tutwiler Prison, which is the only women's prison in Alabama. And I can remember when they took us up on that chain gang. And, you know, the big book talks about that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I could stand up here for hours. Some of you are like, please, no, God. And tell you about that pitiful and that demoralization that we go through as alcoholics. You know, waking up and with people you don't know, sleeping in abandoned cars, abandoned houses, panhandling, you know, and the list just goes on and on. And this was one more of those times of that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. They took us up on that chain gang to that prison, and they stripped you down, and they sprayed you down like an animal. And for the next 2.5 years, that's exactly how I lived, like an animal. You know, I can remember that first day in there, they spray you down and your hair starts falling out from that spray they put in it. And I went up to the issuing officer and she gave me my clothes that I was going to be wearing there in this fine establishment. And I opened up the bloomers and they were this big. I was like, ma'am, these are a little big. They're not my size. She said, tie them on. So there I was, scared to death in that prison, hair falling out with my bloomers tied on. Now, you would think that you would learn from that, wouldn't you? But it don't take but a couple of days. And this old keen alcoholic mind started trying to figure it out. What went wrong? What went wrong? And I said, I know what it is, drugs. Look what drugs have done to me. And when I get out, I am through with drugs. It is drinking only. And I might smoke a little weed because that's God's herb, you know. And as crazy as it sounds, I believed it with all my heart. I honestly did. I said, I am through with those hard drugs. When I get out, it's drinking only. And I had this beautiful vision. Life was going to be great. White House, picket fence, kids, dogs, cats, me sipping a little good whiskey every now and then, smoking a little good weed. Life was going to be great. So I stayed in that prison for 2.5 years, believing that with all my heart. Now, you could have came up to that prison with your big book, and you could have said, but Tammy, if you take one drink, you know, blah, 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 blah. But you know what? I lived in that delusion that Bill talks about. I lived in the delusion that somehow, some way, someday, I was going to be able to drink and enjoy my, you know, enjoy my drinking and drink like other people. And I believed it with all my heart. Now, I stayed in there 2.5 years, and, you know, I went to a few AA meetings. Actually, I went to quite a few AA meetings. And you'll hear a lot of people that have been in prison say this, and it is the truth. I went because they had coffee and donuts. I mean, you didn't get donuts in prison. You know, if they made donuts in that kitchen, you wouldn't want to eat them, I promise you. So I went to a few AA meetings, and I don't remember anything that was said or anything. All I remember about the AA meetings was the lady that brought them in. And her name was Margaret Duncan, and she's went on to the big meeting in the sky now. She was about this tall. She wore red lipstick. Victor and Carol knew her. And she talked like this, "Hey, sugar." And then she would kiss you on the lip and leave that red lipstick all over you. She wore high heel shoes. She was a pistol, I'm going to tell you what. And I remember asking her one day, I said, "Did they pay you to come up to this place? Why would anybody want to come up there?" And I'll never forget what she said to me. She said, "No, honey, I come up here for free and for fun." She said, "Because every one of you girls are doing my time for me. I should have been here many times." And I've never forgot her saying that. She was one of my heroes in this program. She loved Alcoholics Anonymous till the day she left. And she was really sick in the end, and she was in a nursing home. And she started a meeting in the nursing home. And the last time I saw her, she wanted me to speak at the nursing home. So I went, and there was like a little circle of wheelchairs all around me. She loved AA, and I want to be just like her. I mean, she did. So anyway, that was my only experience with AA, because you remember, I already had my own program I was going to work. The drinking only, smoking a little weed. So they let me out after 2.5 years on an early parole, and my mom picked me up at the front gate. We started down Highway 231, and I said, "Stop at the first convenience store," because I needed a drink after all that. And I bought a six-pack of Budweiser, and I drank that first beer, and I was just like a Tasmanian devil. Back at NEO, back doing everything until they locked me up again. You know, the hardest thing for me ever to admit to myself was that I was an alcoholic. You know, call me a drug addict, because that's pretty cool. But an alcoholic's like my Uncle Clarence. Do I have on a trench coat? No. You know, am I drinking wine? I have a paper bag? No. But why it was so hard for me to admit, I don't know. Because this is the way I drank. When they locked me up, it was a constant just chasing it in prison. We would make julep there. That was our homemade wine at Tutwiler. And sometimes it was a little chunky, but it would get you drunk. And we'd make it out of anything we could. The worst thing is when you'd be fermenting it in the locker boxes there, and in the middle of the night you'd hear boom, and you'd know it blew up the locker box. Man, you'd be sick. You'd be sick. And when they let me out of jail, this is how I drank. Now, picture this. I drank at a place called the Honey for the Bears. It never closed. It stayed open 24/7. So it was good for somebody like me who didn't have a house, a car, a job, or anything, because you could just go there and stay for days. And you just drink till you couldn't hold your eyes open anymore. And then you could just go in a booth and pass out. And then you could just come to and come right back up there, "Buy me a drink, baby." And you never had to leave. And that's the way I drank. You know, since I've been sober, I saw the movie Barfly. And it made me sick, because that was me. That's what I did. I stayed in those bars. I lived in those bars. I'd stay days and wouldn't even bathe. And I'd wait for people to come in. And like a vulture, I would just be all over them. So the hardest thing for me ever to admit was that me, of all people, an alcoholic, no way. So they locked me up again. I stayed out not even a year. And somewhere in this keen alcoholic mind, I decided that I was a doctor. And I was writing prescriptions. And now, I don't know about Georgia, but Alabama doesn't take too kindly to that. And so every prescription that I wrote was a new felony. So I had a bunch of them, okay? I had a bunch of felonies. And I went back in front of that judge. And honest to goodness, by the grace of God, he sentenced me to another 10-year sentence, running wild with the 10-year sentence I had. So I went back to that prison. Now I'm sitting back in that infirmary, and now I've got a 20-year sentence. And I'm thinking, well, what went wrong with the program? You know, the drinking, smoking the good weed, the White House picket fence. Where'd I go wrong? I said, I know. You know, this keen alcoholic mind starts figuring it out, don't it? I know where I went wrong. I shouldn't have never drank that hard liquor. Crazy on hard liquor. This time, it is beer only. Now, you guys are laughing, but you think about it. Whether you were in prison or in a treatment center or at your kitchen table, don't we try all these ways? Didn't Bill talk about them in the big book? You know, one more attempt, one more failure. So I said, that what it is, beer only this time. I'm not even going to smoke any weed. Nobody gets drunk on beer. Nobody. I stayed in that prison for a year and a half. And I believe that with all my heart, that this time is going to be different. I lived in the delusion, Bill talks about, that somehow, someday, I'd be able to drink like other people. I believed it. It may sound, sometimes when I'm even saying it up here, it sounds crazy. But when I was going through it, I believed it with all my heart. I stayed in that prison a year and a half, running my mama back and forth to that parole board. And they set me an early parole, and I got out. She picked me up at the front gate at Tutwiler. I started down Highway 231, stopped at the same convenience store, and got a six-pack of Budweiser, drank that first Budweiser, and was like a Tasmanian devil until they locked me up again. Now, this was my third trip back to Tutwiler, and some of you are out there like this, like, God, I'm tired of going to prison. You think you were tired of going to prison. I was tired of going to prison. This was my third trip back, and luckily, I didn't have a new felony. I just had a parole violation, a dirty urine. You know, I wouldn't work. I wasn't reporting. So he sent me back for a parole violation. This time when I went back, they had what the handy-dandy treatment centers and corrections. Now, I don't know about Georgia, but Alabama, they've got entire prisons that are nothing but treatment. I mean, the entire prison is a treatment center. And you will go through that treatment, and you will finish it. So when I went back this time, you're not going to believe this, they recommended that I needed to go through treatments. I know that's hard to believe. I was baffled, too. I was like, and I don't even know what, I don't even know what I could have came up with. What, light beer only? I mean, what could have, I don't even know. So they recommended I went through that treatment center. When I speak in Alabama, I always tell the newcomers, you know, if you don't get it here in AA with all these nice people and air conditioner, then Department of Corrections will give you treatment. Free treatment. Long treatment. And you will finish it if you want to get out of prison. You will finish it. So anyway, they recommended it. And I can tell you that a lot of things happened for me when I was in the treatment. I always like to share this story. We had speakers that came into the treatment center every week. And there was like 100 women in a dorm. And they would talk to us in our treatment dorm. And one night, my counselor told me to go to the front gate and meet the lady that was coming in, make her feel comfortable, because it was kind of scary coming into the prison, the doors slamming, and, you know, the women will yell all kind of stuff at you. So she said, go up, meet the speaker tonight, bring her down to the dorm, make her feel comfortable. And when I got up there to meet her, it was the girl I took my first drink of alcohol with. When I was 12, she was 11. And I hadn't seen her in about 11 years. We had went our separate ways, and there she was, just glowing, her eyes just glistening. She said, I'm an A&A. And I've been sober a year. And I thought, yeah, right, man, they got some kind of new drug out there, you know, or something. Nobody's that happy in A&A. And she had been sober a year. And so she came back to our dorm, and she told her little goofy story. And she always gets so mad at me because she was my sponsor, you know. I don't like you calling my story goofy. But anyway, she told her story about her dog, Booger. And, you know, and since she had been sober, she loved horses. She always loved animals. And she said, and I named my horse Sober. And so now when I come out of the arena, I can hear, here comes Della riding sober. So anyway, she told her goofy little story, like I was saying, and you know, I believe this with all my heart. She planted a seed for me. That lady planted a seed because, you know, I took my first drink with her. I knew how we drank when we were 12 and 13, alcoholically, you know, and we went our own ways. And I hear so many people say that they don't go into the prisons or jails because they don't have anything to share with them people. They've never been to jail. But, you know, I'm glad she didn't say that because she had never been to jail and she had never been to prison. But she was willing to come in that dungeon that night and carry her experience, strength, and hope and planted a seed for me. So if you get the opportunity to go behind the walls, go. You never know who you're going to see in there. You know, you never know. One more story about speakers, because I just love the speakers that came up there. One night, Joe S. from Montgomery, and he's been sober, I think, 22 or 23 years. Anyway, he had long hair, rode a Harley, you know, and I said, there is no way you can ride a Harley and not at least smoke pot. Come on. And I've had a Harley since I've been sober, and you can do that sober, you know. So Joe came up there, and he had his leathers on and rode his Harley up there to the prison. And so he gave his talk, and we always got to ask questions to all the speakers. You know, the inmates got to ask them questions. And I always sat on the back row, and I asked the same question to every speaker that came in there. Just what do you do for fun? Because, you know, I'm sitting in prison thinking, man, I feel sorry for them people. What a dull, boring life. And they're going home, you know. It's crazy. Honest to God, felt sorry for them. So I asked Joe that night, just what do you do for fun? And usually the speakers, when I'd ask them, they'd start trying to tell me. Well, we go to meetings and we go to Roundup sometimes, and we go to Shoney's, and we go bowling. And they wanted me to get how great AA was. And I'm sitting back there thinking, man, can I stand this much fun, or should I just blow my brains out right now? And I mean, they were trying so hard to get me to understand it. I asked Joe that night the same question, just what do you do for fun? And he looked back at me, and I'll never forget. He said, I tell you this, honey, I'm having a hell of a lot more fun than you're having sitting in the penitentiary. So I still use that lesson today with the girls I sponsor, because we really are wasting our breath trying to explain to a newcomer what we do for fun. Think about it. I just tell them this, you know what? I know this is hard to believe. I know it is. But one day, if you just hang around, one day, sleeping in abandoned cars and abandoned houses, waking up sick, throwing up on yourself, peeing your pants, losing your kids, going to jail, making your mama cry, one day, all that's not going to be fun. I know right now it's hard to believe. I know it is. But if you'll just hang around long enough, one day your perceptions of fun are going to change, you know. So a lot of things happened to me in treatment, and I heard a lot of things, but I had the yeah buts. I don't know if you know about the yeah buts, but I'll go to meetings, but you know, I don't think I need one every night. Now I'll get a sponsor, but she's had to been to prison at least twice. And everything they said, it was, yeah, but. So when I got out, I didn't go to a meeting that first day. Within 24 hours, I was drunk. Within 5 months, I was in my parole officer's office, and he said, you're going back. This would have been my fourth trip back to Tutwiler. I know today that this is where God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because for the first time, I started crying, and I begged this parole officer not to send me back. And he was the meanest parole officer I'd ever had. He wore a hearing aid, and he turned it up and down and up and down. And I said, please don't send me back to that place. I know what I need to do. I just didn't do it. Just give me one chance. He said, I tell you what, I'll give you 48 hours to get yourself somewhere. And if not, I'm locking you up. And he let me walk out of there. So I know today that was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I called my counselor from the prison. And I told her what was going on. And she helped me get in a place in Sylacauga, Alabama, a place called Carradale. And I went there for detox, and, you know, it's a beautiful place. It's a lodge, and I was, this is what happened to me as I remember it. I was sitting out in this field on a picnic table, and I just started crying, and I couldn't stop crying. And I reached out to this God that, you know, I didn't have an understanding, and I said, you know, God, I cannot keep living this way, and if I have to go back to that prison, then just please help me end it all right now, because I can't go back. You know, I know today that I was at that place, the big book talks about that jumping off place, where I couldn't imagine life with alcohol, I couldn't imagine life without it, and I truly wish for the end. That was my moment of that desperation. You know, whatever had to happen for you to hit bottom, and for me to hit bottom, no matter where you were at, you know, it's that moment of desperation when, just like the book talks about a drowning man, and I had to be like that. And I reached out, and God answered my prayer, you know. And I always say I had a spiritual experience there, and I truly believe for me it was. Because it was like, it wasn't a burning bush or anything like that. I'm glad it wasn't, because I probably would have freaked out if a bush would have started burning. But it was like my mind opened up this much. And it was like the next thought that came to me was, AA cannot be as bad as the way you're living. And AA is kind of the last house on the block, Tammy. Now, that may not sound very spiritual to you, but it was very spiritual to me. Because if you would have asked me about AA the day before that, I would have said, AA's great, you know, but it's just a bunch of old men, you know, and they sit around and talk about fishing and drink coffee, and they're too old to drink. And when I get that old, I'll quit too, you know. And I could tell you how awful AA was. Anything you wanted to hear, how awful it was, and I had never even been to AA. So, yes, I believe that day was a spiritual experience for me. You know, the big book talks about a spiritual experience being that emotional rearrangement. Well, that happened to me that day, because it was like, AA's all you got left, just like the last house on the block. So I left that treatment center, and I did everything that I'd been told to do. I went to a meeting the first day. And I started going to meetings every day. And I'll always be so grateful to you guys for loving me unconditionally. Because I don't know about you. Well, you probably were too. But I was pretty sick when I got to AA. I was borderline institutionalized. I was a legend in my own mind, you know. And I walked around with chains and a big old switchblade. Like an idiot, you know, in action. And I'd dap around that group, and I'd get mad at the old-timers, and I'd be in there, I'll carve my initials in their bald head. Can you imagine seeing that? And you guys would just say, keep coming back. Just keep coming back, you know? But then I figured out that you were being smart about that, too. you know how when you have the real sick ones and you do that, you have that tone with it. Just keep coming back. And you kind of look with the look and the tone. So I realized then you were being sarcastic to me. So then when you tell me to keep coming back, I'd want to fight you. I'd be like, no, you keep coming back. And I'd be all up in your face wanting to fight you in a meeting. And I love thinking back to the first days of AA. I mean, it's just, and I love watching newcomers come in because, you know, we talk our own talk. You know we do. Like, they'd say things like, the first drink gets you drunk. And I was like, what in the hell were y'all drinking? Moonshine? And I don't know if y'all hear this one, but the old timers used to say this a lot. If you came in and you were young, and I was 29 when I sobered up. I was young then. I'm not now. And they'd say, I spilt more on my tie than you ever drank. And I said, well, you ought not to spill so much with your old ass. Maybe you would have got sober sooner. You got to love it. You know, business meetings, I didn't argue well. I don't know. I didn't argue. So you know how we are in business meetings, right? I'd be wanting to fight. I'd be kicking chairs over, pulling my knife in business meetings. My sponsor wouldn't let me do any service at the district or area level for 5 years. She said, I can see the headlines now. Person stabbed at area assembly, AA area assembly. But you know, I you guys just love me, and you love me unconditionally, and I'll always be so grateful for that. You know, I had a lot of trouble getting a sponsor. You know, they weren't like lined up. You see women come in now, we're all over them. Here's my number. They weren't doing that to me. I ain't had no numbers. A couple of sick men's numbers that were in there. That's about it. But I finally did get a sponsor, and you know, she was crazy as me. She had problems other than alcoholism. And anyway, she took it on. She did. And her name was Alice. And God, will I ever be so grateful to that lady. She taught me so much about loving AA and the home group and home group service. You know, I want to just kind of share my experience, you know, how it's been, what it's like now through the steps. And newcomers, don't leave. I'm not going to do a step seminar, but just to kind of show you how it's all evolved in my life. This lady took it on. And when I think about step one, I had to drink every drop I had to drink. You know, I had to try every angle. I had to try every way until I got to that point of desperation. When I think of step two of coming to believe in a power greater than this, I think about that sponsor. And I think, you know, I don't know about you, but when I was new, I had a problem a minute. Any newcomers? A lot of problems, aren't there, when you're new? A lot of problems. And I'd call this sponsor. And I don't know, whatever, I'd be wah, whatever the problem was that day. She'd say, okay, meet me at the group. I'd say, okay, she's going to give me the $50 or whatever I needed that time. And we'd get to the AA group, and she would hand me the Comet and the toilet scrubber. And I'd be back there scrubbing those nasty AA toilets thinking, does she know who I am? And what does this have to do with getting sober? What does this have anything at all to do with getting sober? But you know what? I wouldn't drink that day. So I always say step two to me, and Victor always loves this, had a lot to do with scrubbing AA toilets, you know? And so I try that with my newcomers and my girls that I sponsor. Meet me at the group, and we'll get over there, and I'll hand them the Comet, the toilet scrubber, and they'll look at me and go, I don't think so. Just got my nails done or whatever. But, you know, I do. I think about the power of suggestion, you know, when I think of step two. This sponsor suggested that I pray every day. I didn't even really think I believed. She suggested it. I did it. She suggested a meeting every day. I didn't really think I needed that many meetings. She suggested it. I did it. And the days were adding up. You know, when I think of step three, You know, I did step three. She was a big book thumper, and I'm glad she was. And we did step three, just like the book said, and we did it together, and we took the third step prayer together. And I didn't feel very much, you know, from that. A little silly, you know, praying with another person. And it's only in hindsight that I can really see the power of step three when I made that decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God as I understood it. Didn't really know what was going to happen. But it's kind of like God started doing things in my life without my permission. Things just started happening, you know. I'll tell one story about how things just started happening in my life. You know, I dropped out of school when I was in the eighth grade. And I took my GED when I was at Tutwiler at prison. And one day I was sitting at home. I'd been sober maybe, I don't know, seven, eight months, not very long. And a commercial came on. And it said, adults, go back to school. And at the bottom it said, financial aid available. Now, see, I'm an old con, and I've worked the system for many, many years. So I knew financial aid available meant federal money, grant money. I said, you know what? I need some money. So I'm going to go down there and see about getting some of that money. So I went down to Troy University, and there were people everywhere. And I walked up to this lady. Now, remember what I looked like. I'm still knife, chains, looking like an idiot. And I said, I want to see about getting some of that financial aid money. So that lady said, okay, well, take this paper and this paper and go to the next table. Ask the same question. They kept working me around. I was at the last table, been around this whole room. I said, look, lady, I just want to see about getting some of that financial aid money. And she said, well, why don't you go ahead and take one class and you can get your financial aid money next week at the financial aid office. So I'm standing there looking at her. She's looking at me. And she said, what about history? I said, well, I guess history will be all right. So I get back out to my car, I won't even tell you about the car I drove. You can probably just imagine, you know, when I had 8 months sobriety. And I'm sitting in my car and I'm thinking, I'm starting college in the morning and I don't even have a pencil. Now, remember, I dropped out of school in the eighth grade and I'm like, and I'm taking history and I don't even know who in the hell discovered America, you know? And so that's how I started college. And you know what? I'll never forget going to my home group and walking in there. And, you know, they've been watching me for 8 months, just, you know, baffled by the whole thing. And I walk in, I said, man, guess what? I'm starting college in the morning. And they're all just like, what? But you know what? I am so glad I was with a group that said, you know what, Tammy? If you keep your sobriety number one in your life, you can do anything that you want to do. Even though you know they were thinking, good God, Troy University is in for a surprise tomorrow. But you know what? They encouraged me and said, if you keep your sobriety, number one. You know, my grandmother used to always tell me, with God, all things are possible. But I couldn't hear that from her. I couldn't hear it. A bunch of drunks said, Tammy, with God, all things are possible. And I believed you. So that's how I started school. And I always relate it back to the third step. I made that decision and things just started happening in my life. You know, I don't know about you, but I put a lot of energy into putting off the fourth and the fifth step. You know, because I'm a gangster, I'm probably going to have to go to a priest or something. You know how anything will do. So all this energy, I put it off, put it off, put it off. And then I finally did it, and I did the fifth step with my sponsor, and she started telling me things, and I was like, look, you don't need to be telling people that. You know, we clean up well, don't we? We clean up well. So anyway, she told me to do just what the big book said. She, after we finished the fifth step, she told me to go get quiet for an hour, review the first five proposals, take the sixth step, the seventh step prayer, everything the big book said she told me to do. But you know what? I was tired after all that. And so I didn't do any of that. I never sat nowhere for an hour. I left her house, and I just kept getting it. Didn't ever look at the sixth step, seventh, any of the rest of them. And today, I know, my teachers always told me there's no standing still in this program. You're either moving forward or you're moving backwards. And I believe them today because I just kind of stopped right there at the fifth step. Just kind of stopped. Now, I was still going to meetings, bunch of meetings, but I wasn't changing. And the result of that was at like 2 years sobriety, maybe over 2 years sobriety, I found myself rolling around in the parking lot at the AA meeting, fighting another AA member. Now, that don't do much for your spiritual image in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, we were fighting, like, poo-poo fighting. And it didn't do much for my parole program I was working either. My parole officer was like, Tammy, you cannot be fighting people at AA, you know, and... And she signed a warrant on me, and I don't blame her. I don't blame her. The result of that was, it was the biggest turning point in my sobriety because I knew there was no standing still. And I knew that I wasn't changing. You know, I used to hear old-timers all the time saying, you can sober up a horse thief, and all you got is a sober horse thief. And I thought, what in the hell are they talking about? And I know what they're talking about today because I wasn't drinking, but I wasn't changing. You know, I still looked the same, still carried that knife. You know, women, I wasn't working with any women. They were scared to death of me. They didn't even come around me. And so it was the biggest turning point in my life. Instead of like, I whooped her or whatever, I felt about that big. And it was like I was either going to drink or I was going to get back in the steps. Because, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I don't suffer well. I don't like pain. And so by the grace of God, I got back in the steps and started over with my sponsor from step one, and we went through. And, you know, since then, I've made amends to that lady. And, I mean, we don't hang out or anything, but... but she accepted my amends. You know, I went on when I went back through, and I know today that step six and seven were the most powerful steps in my sobriety. They really were. Because, you know, you can write down in a four step what a piece of dirt you are. Then you can tell somebody what a piece of dirt you are. So what? What really? What good does that do? But it was in step seven that I could say, okay, God, if you're so powerful, here it all is. You take it all, the good and the bad. And you do with me what you will. And take away those defects that stand in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellow man. You know, I was not useful. And I can honestly say from that point on, God started changing me a little at a time. You know, I can't change myself. I cannot take away my own defects. If I work on anger... That's what we do. We roll around and we fight. That's how I work on my anger. How you work on yours? If I work on lust, well, I'm not even going to tell you how we do that. But, you know, I cannot take away my own defects. I had to have God. I had to ask God to remove them. And he has. He's removed them, I guess, as needed, you know, for me to be of service and useful to you and to him. Steps 8 and 9, I would just want to touch on these for a minute because it was my experience. These were the steps that, you know, really, they're kind of like the second chance steps for me with my family especially, because this is the way I lived as an alcoholic. This was my war cry. I'm only hurting me. I don't know if you ever said that, but that's all I ever said. I'm only hurting me. You know, my drinking just mainly hurts me. And when I worked the steps, honestly, the 12 steps, I had to look at, that was a delusion. That I was like a tornado that roared through people's lives. And it was a delusion that I could even think that I didn't hurt the people that cared about me. Because I told you, my mom, you know, my mom stuck with me through all those years. And I can remember when I would be standing in that courtroom and that judge would be sentencing me to 10 years in the penitentiary. And I would be looking at him with all the hate that was in me. And I could hear my mom crying behind me, sobbing, crying, because that was her baby girl going to the penitentiary. But I was only hurting me. You know, my mom came to that dirty, stinking prison every week to visit me. Every week. And she cried when she came. And she cried when she left. And I never shed a tear. I never shed a tear. But I was only hurting me. You know, my grandmother is 93. And God has blessed me to be sober these 15 years. I can say I got 15 years sobriety now. And God is... That's funny. My birthday, my anniversary was last month. But my grandmother's 93, and God's blessed me, honest. I mean, you know, I am her angel. Tina will tell you. Tina always comes with me to most of these conventions, and she knows my grandma. And she'll tell you, I'm her angel. I do not. It's sickening, really. It really is. And I'm her only granddaughter. And in my drunkenness, and you know, the delusion, I'm only hurting me. I was robbing my grandmother's house one day, and I knocked a table over, and her family Bible fell off, and little pieces of paper came out of the Bible. And I started picking it up and reading them, and every one of them were prayers for me. Because her preacher said if she would put her prayers in her favorite verse, God would hear them. I was robbing her house, but I was only hurting me. You know, I have one brother, and he honestly has always worshiped the ground I walk on. And, you know, when my grandfather died, my brother was his heart. And he left my brother everything he had. And he didn't have a lot of money, but he left him his coin collections, a couple of rifles, some knives, you know, the grandfather's stuff. And in my drunkenness, I stole every bit of that stuff and sold it probably for a bottle of wine. But I'm only hurting me. You know, this program has allowed me to go back through my life and try to amend this to the best I can with my family. You know, my mom, you talk about what this program does for families. When I graduated in 96 with my bachelor's degree, and I'll tell you that my mom was the proudest mother in that place. And for the first time, I was able to make her proud. You know, I was always a good starter, but I was never a good finisher, you know. And I was able to walk across that stage in that stupid cap and gown thing. And I gave her a card that night, and I said, I hope that I have finally made you a proud mom. You know, and she was. I was waiting any minute for her to have pom-poms or whatever, because she was, you know. My grandma, you know, I'm able to go over every Sunday, I go have dinner with her. And as you can tell, she cooked some good biscuits. And I would have never been able to do that if it wasn't for AA. And, you know, not long ago, and she's a pistol, I'm going to tell you, she's 93. She drove a car up until a little over a year ago because she drove her car through the farmer's market there in Montgomery. I mean, through it, you know. And we had to take her car from her. And, you know, she's 93, and she's just had to move out of her house over the past 42 years and into a retirement home. And, you know, and I'm watching her health go some. And you guys, what you've given my family and me is the ability to be there for her, to be there for my grandmother. You know, just yesterday, she had me out all over town shopping, you know, and I can do that today because you gave me that. That's what you've done for my family. You know, my brother, He's an attorney today. He went back to school since I've been sober, and he's an attorney. That's a resentment in his home. He should have been an attorney back then. He's not an alcoholic. He's very normal. I don't know how it happened. I don't get it, but he is. And I live right down the hill from him and his wife and his two kids. And, you know, you guys have repaired all that. You know, you gave me a path that has worked, you know, and I've been able to make those amends. My dad's back in my life, and a lot of times, bless his heart, I leave him out as the Harley riding, dope selling pool shooter, which he was, you know, but, you know, I don't know if he's an alcoholic or not. I know he's married to a good woman that keeps him straight, and he's living back in the Montgomery area, and we have a relationship today, and that's all because of you guys. You know, I've made amends. I've made financial amends. You know, my sponsor said, Tammy, you need to make amends to society. And I said, well, how do you do that? She said, well, why don't you apply for a pardon? And I didn't see what that had to do with anything, but I did it. When I applied in Alabama, they told me I needed one in Georgia. So today I have a full pardon from the state of Georgia and the state of Alabama. The last election, I got to vote for the first time. And voting's a privilege. It really is a privilege, and it can be taken away from you. And I was so excited, and I was down there, what do you do? What do you do? And people were looking at me like, lady, this is not fun, you know? And where's your old ass been all these years, you know? So amends, you know, second chances. I know my time's getting short, but, you know, I continue to try to grow and improve my relationship with the God of my understanding. And I can honestly tell you today, the most important thing that has happened in my life is that big hole in my gut that only alcohol and drugs would fill. You know, today I have a God of my understanding, and I never thought that would be possible. I really didn't. I heard somewhere down the line that God was taking names and checking them later. And he had a 357 in one hand, a ball bat in the other. I don't know where I got all that from. But a group of drunks gave me a way that has worked. And today I have a God of my understanding in my life, in my heart. You know, I never thought that would be possible. Just a couple of things on the 12th step. You know, when I was sober, I don't know, a few years, I was able to go back to that same prison and take an AA meeting in there. And I was able to tell those ladies, you don't have to live like this anymore. There's another way. And, you know, I could go in there and hold my head high, not feel better or less than anybody in there. One of the nicest things that was ever said about me was said right there at that prison. I listened to a lot of speaker tapes. Johnny Harris is one of my heroes in the program. If you hadn't heard him, you need to listen to him. And he told this story about when he was in prison, how dedicated and committed the AA people were. And that no matter what, they would be there to chair that meeting every week, no matter what. And I used to just get chill bumps thinking, wow, I wish I was that committed and dedicated. And he said one night the road was closed for 15 miles. And the guard was standing out there. And he said, Johnny, the AA man's not coming tonight. The roads are closed for 15 miles. Johnny said, yeah, that AA man will be here. And he said, sure enough, a few minutes later, they heard a bell. And here come the AA guy, I think his name was Jim, on a horse and sleigh. With his big book to bring the AA meeting to the prison. And I used to just get chills. It just, I mean, I couldn't believe it. When I was taking the meeting to Tutwiler, one night there was a tornado that had hit 5 miles from the prison. And the inmate that chaired the meeting was standing out there waiting for me to come in. And the guard told her, said, Tammy's not coming tonight. There's a tornado 5 miles from here. And that inmate said, oh, yeah, Tammy will be here no matter what. And she believed in my commitment and my dedication to Alcoholics Anonymous that much. This same drunk that my mom didn't even know if I'd be there for Christmas or birthdays or any holidays. This lady believed in me that much. And sure enough, a few minutes later, here I came. I get out of my car, my umbrella turns inside out, because it really was a tornado. I mean, it was going through. But the nicest thing ever said, I've been able to work in a lot of service positions. I have believed in service work from the scrubbing that toilet till today. I believe there's magic in service. And once you put your hands on, it's yours. You know, once you make that first pot of coffee or clean that toilet or sweep that floor, something happens. There's a magic in it, and I believe that. I've been able to sponsor a lot of ladies, and I want to tell you this one story, and then my time's about up. You know, growing up, I don't have kids, but growing up, I was a bad kid. I don't know about you. My mom used to say, when you grow up and have kids, they're going to put you through everything you put me through. Did your mom ever tell you that? And so I don't have kids, but sponsorship. Sponsorship. Let me tell you what. I'm sitting out there a couple years ago, because I usually get the sickest of the sickest when I sponsor. And I got this lady, just came out of prison, right out of prison, been out a week or two. Now they bust a sag and they wear braids, and she had a big switchblade. And she came out of the meeting and she said, if she looks at me one more time, I'm going to slice her throat. And I was like, oh my God, don't cut her. Let's pray. Let's pray together. For the grace of God. There go up. I want to tell you one thing. My grandmother's a Southern Baptist, and her and God are just like this. And she told me, and I believe her, when you meet your maker, there's going to be one question that you're asked. And that question's going to be, how well have you served me? And if that's the question, and if I stay in the middle of AA, I'm going to be okay. Me and God are going to be okay. You've gave me the opportunity to serve, to have a purpose, and to be useful. And I thank you so much for that. I'm going to close with this prayer that means a lot to me. And one of my teachers that's went on used to say it all the time. And it's, God, I know I'm not what I could be. And God, I know I'm not what I should be. But thank you, God, I'm not what I used to be. Thank y'all so much for having me. Thank you.